Welcome to She's History. I'm your host, Laura Borsma. In this episode, I talked to historian Bianca Rolette about Jean Kirkpatrick, the first woman to serve as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under Reagan's administration. This is an interesting conversation because it's very topical now with discussing how fragile democracy really is. Jean Kirkpatrick was a very controversial figure and is known for the Kirkpatrick Doctrine that justified supporting authoritarian right-wing regimes and dictatorships as long as they were anti-communist. The effects of this approach to foreign policy had a major impact on Central America. So we talked about how she believed there should be more women in politics, her emphasis on gradual change, and how through all of this you can really see how fragile democracy is. You can read Bianca's essay and other great essays in the book Suffrage at 100, Women in American Politics Since 1920. Let's dive in.
I feel like for the movie, Annette Bening should play her. She's kind of
I could see that. I don't know if Annette Bening would play her, but
well, yeah, that's true. I guess it would depend on the story. So what got you into writing about her? Where did this essay idea come from?
I've been researching Jean Kirkpatrick for several years now. When I was a master's student at the University of Arkansas, I needed something to write my thesis over, and I was just reading in a textbook about American foreign relations in the 1980s, and they were talking about Dr. Jean Kirkpatrick and the Kirkpatrick Doctrine. I'm like, who's this woman in diplomacy? Because that was, you know, not common. And so I kind of became interested in this female that had some kind of diplomatic power when women hadn't before. And it just kind of started from there. So I did my master's thesis on her and my dissertation. Yeah. And then wrote this chapter.
I didn't honestly know much about her either. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting, just a woman in Reagan's administration in the foreign policy department. I feel like that's exactly what Phyllis Schlafly wanted in to do foreign relations. So, I mean, I wonder how she felt about Jean Kirkpatrick, but I don't know.
I'm not even going to speculate there. I can't honestly say, and it'd be fun to speculate between the two of them, but I'm not going to do it. But yeah, before Reagan appointed her, Jean Kirkpatrick was the first female appointed as UN ambassador to the United Nations from the United States, and the first from a Western country too. So even beat Western Europeans there. And she was the first female to sit on the National Security Council and the National Security Planning Group. And these are the foreign policy entities that kind of create and dictate what policy directives are going to be like. As the first woman there, I see her as kind of helping to shatter that glass ceiling that's preventing women from having more say in diplomacy. And then after Kirkpatrick, you start seeing more women be appointed to higher positions, like Madeleine Albright under the Clinton administration, Condoleezza Rice under Bush, and then Hillary Clinton under Obama. So I see her as, you know, paving the way for female secretaries of state and women to have more power in diplomacy than they had before.
Let's talk about her, the Kirkpatrick Doctrine, because I feel like that's what she's most known for. What is that?
So the Kirkpatrick Doctrine relates to non-democratic governments and how American foreign policy is used towards non-democratic states. And what she does is she makes distinctions between different types of non-democratic governments. You have right-wing authoritarian governments that may have military dictators or kings or emperors or things like that. But you also have these totalitarian systems, communist systems or fascist systems. And they're also non-democratic, but they're much more extreme autocracies than your average run-of-the-mill right-wing dictatorship. And so what she's arguing is, you know, the United States wants to make the world safe for democracy, you know, and protect other democracies. And sometimes to do that, we have to deal with countries as they are, non-democratic or whatnot. And might be critical of human rights abuses or their political systems or the way these countries run, there are degrees again to how bad it could be. And better us to ally ourselves with a more traditional authoritarian regime than a totalitarian one. And there are many reasons for that. Traditional autocracies allow political opponents to sometimes publish papers, to have parties. They will allow for mass demonstrations sometimes, for unions to strike. These are different kinds of political activities that they do allow. They don't stifle out all opposition. They don't institute, she would say, cultural revolution, social revolution in their countries. And so they allow the normal parts of life to carry on. You can go to church where you want to. You can live where you want to. You can observe whatever cultural customs or taboos that you want to. Whereas in a totalitarian state, the goal with fascism or communism is to completely remake all of society from the ground up. And to do that, you have to destroy what is traditional and normal. And that's what happened in Nazi Germany. That's what happened in communist Russia when, you know, like in communist Russia, the Orthodox Church becomes, you know, illegal. You can't do that. You know, you're forced to work in certain ways. People are taken out of the countryside and moved into the city. All of these things causing refugees and stuff like this. And so her point was that in dealing with these regimes, it's better for us to deal with the lesser of two evils. It's a reality in our world. Most governments in the world are not liberal democratic systems. They're authoritarian, they're right wing. We have to deal with them as they come. We can hope to pressure them to change in some ways through our policies, but we can't expect perfect change overnight, right? And we can't expect that by giving them some money or some aid, they're going to automatically become democracies. And this was her criticism of Carter, as he had taken aid away from some dictators that we had been provided military and economic aid from because they had some human rights abuses. They were facing revolutions they were trying to put down. And once he took that aid away, those countries fell and new regimes came to power that were hostile to the United States, who had ties to either the communist world or were totalitarian systems. So in her opinion, that's worse than what was there before.
From her point of view is that these people that were still within the, just who lived underneath this government, they still needed help. And we should still help them, even though their government was not a democracy, not great, but just to help keep them to where it doesn't turn into a really bad refugee situation. And then,
or from her point of view, because she's also very much a cold warrior, she's constantly thinking about, you know, who might fall under the Soviet bloc, right? Or Soviet or communist influence,
right?
And ties with that kind of totalitarian system.
How interesting. I wonder what she would think of Trump.
Oh my. I'm not sure what to say about that, because she was a political science professor. She studied political science. She believed greatly in the democratic process and the rule of law. And so because of her beliefs in constitutional law and how democracy functions, I do not think she would be supporting a lot of his moves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So just backing up earlier in her life, because she was a Democrat. And yeah, then she switched to be a Republican. So why did she switch?
There's a lot of things that got her to the other side. Kirkpatrick was born a yellow dog Democrat, which is, I'm sure you've heard, is the term for Southerners back in the day. They'd vote for a yellow dog before they'd vote for a Republican, right? You know, her mom had a saying on this that they would vote for a Democrat as long as he hadn't been convicted of a felony. So that was their version of yellow dog.
Wow.
And supposedly her dad once told her that she could bring home a black boy or an Indian boy, but she could not bring home a Republican.
Wow.
She's coming from this very Southern strong tradition of being very, you know, pro-Democrat. And then, of course, with her marriage, she gets very active in the Democratic Party, active on the national level. But what's going to push her to move away from the Democrats are a couple of things. Number one, the rise of the new left, right? So you have in the 1960s, all of these new protest groups, you know, civil rights, feminism, anti-war protests, student protests, all of these kinds of rights revolutions that are going on in the later 60s. It's not that she disagrees with kind of their overall goals, but she disagrees with their methods and the way they go about it and other aspects of the movement. She didn't like their anti-American attitude. They were always criticizing the American government. She didn't like mass demonstrations, this kind of action and the violence that it wrought from authorities figures. She didn't like that. She believed that these new leftist groups, especially the radical groups, Black Power, Women's Lib, things like that, were trying to institute a cultural and social revolution in the United States. That they were trying to instantaneously change how society and culture worked.
Yeah.
And had a deep, deep education in the evils of totalitarianism, which I didn't get to talk about in the chapter. Like, she is steeped in this. And everything she has ever read is when you have a group that's out there agitating in that way, that's criticizing the government so severely, that's trying to completely change culture, she sees them as being fascists or totalitarians. And what they want to do is completely remake society, which would cause chaos. And it would require terror, you know, as totalitarians would. So she kind of saw them like that. She viewed them as being similar to the fascists in Germany in 1930s.
Wow.
Criticizing the German government and attacking and having mass demonstrations and stuff. And she saw them as being very similar to communist groups like that in other countries as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is pretty, I mean, that's interesting though, because it's so much of it just came from, you know, anti-equality sentiment and just wanting a more equal government and equal world. But yeah, that's interesting though. If you look at it from someone who studied totalitarian regimes, that is like, yeah, you could see how certain things could be scary.
Right. And here's the thing. When people talk about this in the 1960s and 70s, there's that whole big political shift, you know, where the New Deal coalition of Democratic Party breaks apart because of these protest movements. A lot of the cons are really just old school liberals, right? Like they believe the same thing they believed after World War II with, you know, Truman's Fair Deal. It's just the world has changed. Now these people that are protesting weren't born. They didn't grow up in the Depression and World War II. They didn't grow up being taught the evils of communist expansion or totalitarianism, whether it's fascist or communism. They didn't live through World War II. You know, they were born after. They're baby boomers. She thinks that they just don't understand the struggle that the United States has been through to try to make the world safe for democracy. She hates their foreign policy views. You know, a lot of the new left opposed, you know, the U.S. war in Vietnam. They, you know, want the United States to not be so interventionist in other countries. But she believes that that's the only thing making the world safe and protecting everyone from communism. But she thinks they don't see that because they missed World War II. They didn't grow up with that fear that she did.
Yeah.
Neocons in the 70s have the same mindset they had in the 50s. They just have to switch parties because everything else changes, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. So neocon is the neoconservative. And this was the neoconservative movement that sort of rose out in the... When did that start? Like, what's a little bit more history on that one?
There's a really good book by Justin Vossi called Neoconservatism, The Biography of a Movement. And he argues that there are three stages of neoconservatism. One in the early 1950s, that's growing out of the burgeoning Cold War. The second phase is in the 1960s.
McCarthyism, and when you see that like anti-communist McCarthyism stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
In the 60s, you see a lot of liberals start being very critical of American foreign policy and domestic policy. So it's both their critique of the new left and what they're trying to do, and then their views on foreign policy that kind of push them into their own little thing in the 60s and 70s.
So the belief is that America should be more involved, like basically the police of the world. And tell it, because is that also a big reason why a lot of conservatives were not the biggest fans of the UN?
Well, they see a difference between, that's a complicated and very good question, and I was not sure how I was going to approach that. to the neoconservatives and Republicans as they emerged out of that, the number one priority is American national security, right? Our national security interest. And unfortunately, when you talk about national security interests, we do have to be selfish because you're thinking only of your own country and what's good for my own citizens. Whereas when you're working through the UN or you're going through other collective organizations, you're dealing with the impacts and opinions of other people, right? And what they want and what they see. So that if we might have to compromise, right? And not look after just our national security. If we're working with other people, we have to think about others as well and what's good for the group as a whole. And sometimes in doing that, we might not focus as much as we should on our own priorities. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah.
But Kirkpatrick believed that, especially in the 20th century and later 20th century, that there's this idea that we can establish some kind of utopian world, right? Like if we all work together, we can establish a better world and stuff like that. But she thinks that's kind of like fantasy, and that it's not reality. So we have these high hopes of being able to do these things, but human nature being what it is, we're not going to be able to do that. And so better to kind of focus on ourselves and not get caught up in these kind of globalizing agendas, you know. Plus, the more we're into kind of a global environment, the less attention we pay to ourselves and our own specific interests.
That totally makes, I mean, I feel like that's the mantra of the current Republican Party, the me, me, me. Well, actually, there was my partner, John, he saw an article that was talking about, it was Republicans in Nebraska, in a very small town, and they were talking about the election and the results and why this guy, like, why is it? And it's like, because I feel like it's all about looking after myself. Like, mm-hmm. No one else is looking after me. No one else is helping me but me. So I want to be with the party that feels the same way that I identify the most with, is that it's just all about looking after number one.
But, you know, if you're in charge of national security, you are in charge of looking out for number one.
But she did. I like in your essay, you talk about, though, that she did like the idea of figuring out the roots, like what caused people to become refugees or what caused people and helping to stop that. So then that way, it serves multiple interests. It helps these people who are in a state where, so they don't have to be refugees, and also helps America in terms of our immigration. Like, so then people don't feel like they have to come over here. So that's, so she's sort of, I know it's very complicated. It's very complicated.
It is. She's a very complex woman, in my opinion.
I was also looking on Wikipedia too, and there was a quote. Noam Chomsky referred to her as chief sadist in residence of the Reagan administration. It's like, yes. And that, I mean, was she viewed, and you, in your essay, you talk about too, how she was viewed by, she was a very controversial figure.
Mm-hmm.
How does she come across?
Well, when you talk about how she comes across, the difficulties in that, especially being the first female in that position, is some of the stuff that's said about her, you don't know how much of that would have been said about a man saying or doing the same thing. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Chief sadist, I find kind of hard to swallow, considering who else worked for the Reagan administration. And other things that were being done, I find that to be, well, just wrong. So there is that. But she did not back down from what she believed. And she firmly believed that the Russians, the communists, wanted global domination, that the best human rights policy for the entire world was for the United States to continue to contain them, to do whatever we can to stop their influence and keep them from spreading. And she was willing to support a number of policies to make that happen, sometimes in controversial ways. So like she had to defend, for example, the government of South Africa during the 1980s, because in the UN, there's this whole debate about Namibian independence in South Africa, but the Reagan administration is supporting South Africa, who's still kind of ruling over Namibia because of lots of different factors. But it made her look like she was on the side of imperialism, right? Like not,
right.
But this was all Cold War related in her mind, right?
You don't know what was sexist or what was like actually criticizing her policy, because some of it was pretty intense and pretty,
yes,
pretty harsh. Yeah.
For example, there were four American nuns that had been traveling in Central America, and they were raped and murdered in El Salvador. And she made a comment about how they weren't really nuns. They were leftists. They were working with communists in Nicaragua. They had ties to the Sandinistas.
Oh, wow.
Saying things like that, yeah, that's not going to get you the best of reputations. She went to speak at several universities and would be booed off stage, and she'd have to have extra protection. She had the Sandinistas, or no, the Contras, you know, that group that's trying to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, named a battalion after her, the Jean Kirkpatrick Brigade, because of her support for them. And throwing, you know, covert aid at them to try to overthrow that government. So she definitely supported some controversial things. And so naturally, she's going to be criticized for it. But also, she consistently argued against sending American troops into Central America or into other problematic regions. And she did, you know, sometimes argue against a lot of Reagan players on policy about what she thought should be done. So she just tried to stick up for what she thought to be the truth based on her own studies and understanding and kind of stick with it.
Well, there's another quote about she did not get along with either Secretary of State. You talk about that in your article.
Mm-hmm.
She disagreed with Shultz, most notably on the Iran-Contra affair, in which she supported skimming money off arms sales to fund the Nicaraguan Contras. And then Secretary of State said that that could be an impeachable offense to do because of the massacres perpetuated by the group. And then, so, because they had a big effect on South America, Reagan's foreign policy.
Yeah, Central America in particular. Yeah, that's a big highlight for them because it's right on our border. Like, there's an old saying that Latin America is our backyard, you know, it's our own backyard, and we better pay attention. King Kirkpatrick called it our front yard. So she at least put it in the front of the house, I guess.
Yeah.
Panama Canal's there. A lot of trade goes through there. A lot of troops go through this area. We had a lot of allies in that region. We've got a lot of trade in that region. So when it comes to our national security, keeping communism away from our border is important, right?
Yeah.
She believed that Central America, especially since Nicaragua was now under the rule of communists and there's a civil war in El Salvador, we've got communists on one side and, you know, right-wing dictator on the other, had to prevent communism from spreading there. Vital to our national security, vital for human rights around the world.
Yeah. So they were trying to put in a democratic form of government, or at least just support the anti-communist regimes.
Right. And not necessarily trying to put in a democratic form of government. Kirkpatrick wrote her dissertation on Peronist Argentina. She had to do some research on Latin American political systems, which normally she did totalitarianism. So this was kind of out of her wheelhouse. And it's that work that got her the reputation as a Latin American expert, which she was not and would have been the first to admit that she was not.
Oh, wow.
On what she had read, their systems of government, you know, Latin American political systems did not have a long history of democracy. You know, you had colonial rule by the Spanish, imperial there, and then you had a bunch of military dictatorships, and occasionally you'd get a constitution and we'd have democracy for a few years, and no, some military dictator throw the whole thing off. She's looking at these systems in Central America. She's like, yeah, they're right wing, but they've got all these interesting characteristics. We need to study them more in depth. And better to have, you know, Somoza there if we can work with him in Nicaragua than communists. His government's not going to be perfect. And, you know, he is a dictator, but we can still work with him on various policies.
That's what I have trouble understanding, is that the America first mentality of not wanting to get involved. And then, but then because of the America first, feeling obligated to get involved. So it's kind of like, it's sort of like, which is it? Do we get involved or not? But I guess it's complicated.
She would argue that we would get involved in most cases because that is part of putting America first. Central America is important to our national security. So it's important to us to not let communism spread there. So we should be very active there as much as possible. Now, she's not going to say that we can't support dictators because they're dictators. And she's not going to say that even though we support them, we expect them to become Democrats. She didn't. She thought it would take time. Like, she argued that democracy took time. And we Americans keep expecting to create democracy anywhere, anytime, in any conditions. And that's just ridiculous. Even our national experience shows that we didn't even have democracy, full democracy for most of our citizens until the 1960s, right? So it took that long for voting rights and whatnot to be extended, even in the world's most premier democracy. So how can we expect Somoza in Nicaragua, a military dictator, to suddenly like turn his country into democracy overnight? Like, it's not going to happen.
And then you see how fragile it is as well.
Yeah. And this, I think, is one problem she eventually had. Like, in 2003, her last act of government service was she did go to the UN and defend American actions in Iraq, because we're coming off of 9/11 and Bush has started the war on terrorism. We're going to invade Iraq. And there's a lot of international opposition to that. And she went to defend that. I had a point to that. But later, she regretted that action, in part because once Saddam Hussein was toppled, we then had to engage in nation building. That man had been in power for so long. This is an argument she makes about dictators. They're bad, but the government around them are connected to them because they're so personal. And the longer they're in power, the more government's wrapped up in that dictator, what they say and what they do. So that when you appear, the entire political system falls apart, which requires a lot more work to build up, right? I'm going to go at them here and say our only two successful ventures at nation building, and somebody's going to yell at me for this, is Japan and West Germany after World War II.
But it took, yeah, total collapse and
years of money and work, lots and lots of money, lots of help, lots of aid. Yeah.
I mean, if those weren't, why didn't I guess every culture and every government is just different too. So it's just like, it's, very complicated. She was ambassador to the UN for 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. And then why did she resign? Why did she stop being ambassador?
I'm not 100% sure on that. She died in 2006, so I never actually got to speak to her or interview her. And I'm relying on stuff that I can find that she's written or that people who have interviewed her have. I don't have access to her papers. I've been told she doesn't really have much. So I have read speculation that she in part resigned because she could not get promoted, that she really wanted to be national security advisor or something higher. And that since that hadn't happened and wasn't going to happen, and she was tired of the UN, she decided to leave. Now, what she has written about it, and again, I don't know how honest she was being because it's for public consumption. She stayed at the UN as long as she did because so few ambassadors had for so long. Like, she was our longest serving UN ambassador since Adlai Stevenson in the early 1960s. And ever since then, we had really high turnover rate with UN ambassadors. So she wanted to at least make it through a full term doing that. But I think she found that kind of frustrating.
Well, yeah, in your essay, you talk about, how she was annoyed with the UN because America was paying the most, but not getting the amount of voice that she felt was worthy of the money that was being put in. So she felt America should just have a stronger voice than it was.
Right. And plus, the UN, its precursor, the League of Nations, these were kind of American ideas and inventions.
So Reagan was a big ally for her, but people within his administration, and whether they were sexist or not, they weren't huge fans. And then she also, and then feminists, like you talk about Gloria Steinem and other prominent feminists were also not huge fans. She was really getting it from both sides. Like, a lot of her views were very feminist and all about women being in a more equal world. But as you say, she just felt like it should be a slower process than the feminists thought.
Well, I think her concern with that is it's hard to legislate against mores or social ideas. So the Brown decision, for example, Brown v. Board of Education, when the Supreme Court ruled that segregation in education is unconstitutional and said that schools needed to integrate at all deliberate speeds. All right, that's great. That's a law. And we can agree that that's probably a good thing. But just because that's there, just because the Civil Rights Act gets passed a few years, does not mean that Americans' attitudes towards African Americans changed overnight. It's not like one day the Civil Rights Act passed and everybody is holding hands singing Kumbaya, Like, you can legislate against what society thinks is normal, but they're still going to resent it. And if you go too far, she thinks there'd be a backlash, right?
Right.
And it'd be difficult to institute a cultural revolution anyway without using force, which she thinks would be wrong. And so her main concern is just to get rid of political discrimination, to have political equality and non-discrimination in education and employment, things like that. And then once that's in place, then it's up to everybody based off their own intelligence, their hard work. Luck plays a part in everything that we do to determine where we end up with in life. And her emphasis on gradual change is similar in domestic and foreign affairs, because she believed that authoritarian regimes could over time become democracies, but it would be a slow and gradual change.
Yeah.
And perfect democracy cannot be brought out overnight. It requires citizens who are willing to do research and understand what's going on. Parties have to be formed. You have to be willing to accept the results of elections. You have to do a number of things for democracy to function. That's why today's so worrisome. And it takes time for that. And so she's all about the gradual change. Now, she argued, though, she gave speeches in front of women's groups when she was UN ambassador. In the 70s, she did some work for the UN for their International Women's Year. She went and spoke in West Africa. She was fluent in both French and Spanish, which is very unique for American ambassadors. So she was able to go to Spanish-speaking and French-speaking lands and actually speak their language, which was appreciated. So she worked for the National Women's Year through the UN and gave talks in West Africa about female equality and advancement of women. And she did give talks about how she felt like more women needed to be in college, more women needed to be in politics. She wrote one of the first books on women in politics in 1974, Political Woman. Since she was able to accomplish so much that she did without feminism, I guess she saw this more about herself as kind of a rugged individualist, you know, and she felt that other people could do that too. And I don't think that she, and I can't, again, this is my opinion, I'm not sure she considered the fact that she was, that she had some advantages because she was, you know, middle class, white, things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah. So it's a, yeah, it's kind of like all the, well, this is like Phyllis Schlafly too, the all the benefits of feminism and then being able to decide that I don't want to call myself a feminist, but I'm going to go ahead and like, I love all the benefits that come with it. So keep them coming.
What I thought was very interesting, she gave a speech once, and I get to talk about this in the chapter, where she argued that it was vital for women to become more active in foreign affairs around the world. We need a lot more women involved in government, politics, and diplomacy. But she argued that in the United States, and this was in like the late 80s, early 90s, she said this, that the State Department system was so bad that she could not see a female being promoted up to Secretary of State going through the normal bureaucratic system, that they would have to be outsiders and would most likely come from academia.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then, oh, you know, Madeleine Albright, academic outsider, not going up through the system. Condoleezza Rice, academic outsider, you know, that kind of stuff. The State Department, you know, bureaucracy, foreign service, that kind of thing.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting. And it's hard because she's surrounded by conservatives who look at women's roles in a very different way. So she's showing by example, listen, women can be leaders and women can do more than just be at home. Unless they want to, of course. But like,
And she believed that she, by just doing her job at this position, being the first woman in that position, would open doors for women to do more later. And she was happy about that.
Thank you again to Bianca Rolette, and thank you all for listening.